This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Darren Wong grew up in an old farmhouse with a lot of history. Legend had it that the house in Town Line, New York, was one of the last stops on the Underground Railroad, a significant distinction all by itself. But it is all the more interesting when you consider the fact that Town Line was also the only place north of the Mason-Dixon line that voted to secede from the Union. That's a true story. And Darren's debut novel is mostly true, too. The Hidden Lights of Northern Fires tells the tale of Mary Willis, the real-life proprietor of his childhood home, and the way she railed against the conventions of her family and community. In the next month, Darren's going to be speaking and reading in Chapel Hill, Raleigh, Durham, Charlotte, and Greensboro. We've got information at our website. But first, Darren joins us right now. Welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much, Frank. I'm thrilled to be here.
Darren Wong, crazy story in this town you grew up in, not far from the town I grew up in, and I had no idea the Town Line had such a history. Tell us more about the town you grew up in and how you found out about its history.
Well, so Town Line seceded from the Union. This really is bizarre. In December of 1861, it's a tiny little crossroads place. I think the vote was 100 to 21 to secede. There's no real legal standing for it. It's called Town Line because it's the line between the town of Alden and Lancaster. But Town Line was essentially founded by Nathan Willis, who had come west from Vermont in 1811 and built a farmhouse and a farm and a sawmill, and the town grew up around him. And then he sent his daughter off to Alfred University, which is only the second school in the country to accept women. And she came home in 1858 and started running an underground railroad station in his barn. They converted the barn years later. Town Line didn't rejoin the Union until 1946.
1940. But apparently the Union, by then the United States of America, didn't really notice.
Yeah, essentially nobody noticed, and including folks over in Clarence, where you said you're from. It was the reunification kind of publicity stunt happened in the wake of World War II, and it got a lot of national press then. Town Line, up until a few years ago, used to the only kind of civic organization is Town Line Fire Department, and their shoulder patch up until a few years ago said "Last of the Rebels, 1865 to 1946."
Well, so this is why this is so interesting, because for some reason the folks in that Western New York town decided they wanted to secede from the Union, so they had some apparently kinship with the Confederacy, and yet the last stop on the a town this small to be the last stop on the Underground Railroad. Folks would have known. Do you know much about that and whether or not everybody knew what was going on, that they knew that this was the last stop on the railroad?
Well, the railroad is, it's not a unified spot, right?
But the fact that they were harboring escaped slaves in a town that had voted to side with the Confederacy seems to me unusual.
it certainly is. I don't know, there's not many contemporary records from Town Line in that era, and so much of that had to be imagined. But I would imagine that there certainly was a good deal of antagonism between Mary Willis and the town around her. It's funny how when you read these stories of the Underground Railroad, anything kind of written in the years after the oral histories written in the years right afterward. There's always kind of a cutesy, jokey nature to them from a lot of perspectives. You know, there's this winking knowledge and everything, but it kind of ignores the real grave danger that was going on there. And the area was rife with what was called copperheads. People who were really antagonistic to the Union cause and were sympathetic to the Confederacy and all of those issues.
Well, that makes the story all the more interesting. Tell us more about Mary Willis, who is the protagonist in your novel.
Yeah, so she's she comes home. She's running this underground railroad station, and she's essentially, just that biography tells you. She's a radical feminist and abolitionist in a place where those things essentially started. Frederick Douglass is, you know, is nearby in Rochester at this time, and Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, they're the Southern, you know, the Seneca Falls Convention's nearby. Mm-hmm. So I really pictured, as I'm learning Mary Willis's history, you know, from some oral histories from their family that I dug up, I really pictured her as being kind of imbued by the radicalism of the place at the time.
Well, maybe I can ask you to read from your new novel and you can set it up for us, but this really is an introduction to Mary Willis herself.
Yeah, so this is during the fairly opening pages, and it tells a little bit about Mary. Mary Willis came home to Town Line in May of 1859. She brought with her an Alfred University diploma, a copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe, and a bundle of anti-slavery tracts tied neatly with grocer's string. The diploma was one of 26 earned by young ladies in New York State that year. The book was heavily annotated by Mary and inscribed to her by Mrs. Stowe herself. The tracts she carried down to Snyder's General Store the next Saturday afternoon and handed out as she recited a debate society perfected Jeremiad on the peculiar Southern institution of slavery. She had lived among the immigrant farmers for all her life and should have known that most of them spoke only German and could not read a word in English, but she was encouraged by how quickly her bundle disappeared. The farmers spent all their worrying hours focused on rainfall, hoeing, and late frost, and had little concern about the issue that was tearing their adopted nation apart. None refused the paper, though, which would serve as a welcome reprieve from the dwindling supply of dried corn husks piled in the corner of their outhouses.
That's Darren Wong reading from his debut novel, The Hidden Light of Northern Fires. He's going to be reading around the state in coming weeks, and we've got his dates at our website, stateofthings.org. Tell us more about the plot of this novel. There are elements of truth in this, or fact, that you've done a lot of research, and then, of course, you wove in some lovely fiction, including some romance.
Yeah, so the story kind of opens up with Joe Bell, an imagined runaway slave, coming up from Harper's Ferry, where he was attached to a true to life family, the Beals of West Virginia now we're tied in with a Harper's Ferry political thing. So Joe comes and is injured, and Mary has to nurse him back to health. And because he has to stay there, she's in a lot of jeopardy. And that's kind of the starting point. That's happening right at the cusp of the war, right in 1861.
And we see that they have a lot in common, maybe that we hadn't quite imagined before they meet. But this idea of escape was something that's clear in the literal sense for Joe, who has to escape slavery and has his master on his heels. But for Mary as well, escaping the kind of repression of her hometown now that she's become educated and had her eyes open. So they're both, in a way, trying to flee, aren't they?
Yeah, I think that's that's the sensibility. I think Mary and that I think that felt like true to me, to tell you the truth. Growing up at Town Line, I wanted to leave. You know, I wanted to leave that place. And there's I'm fond of it now, looking back. But I can picture this woman feeling really out of place. So there's a sympathy between the two of them.
How much of this book is based on the research, and when did you then decide to turn this into to create the romance between the two?
Well, you know, I did about 3 years of research on it, and it was just what happened was I'd heard these kind of legends, but they didn't cohere into a real story until I typed in my old address into Google, and a oral history popped up about the Willis family, and it kind of filled in a lot of the story and for me, and also asked a bunch of questions for me too, and I spent 3 years kind of deep diving into research, not knowing what I was going to do with it. I hadn't really pictured myself as a novelist at that point, and trying to find some more primary materials and everything. And after 3 years, I finally sat down and said, I've got to make up the parts that I can't find.
How long did it take you then to write the book? Did it start to come to you pretty easily, or did it take a while?
No, it took me quite a while to kind of get a shape and overall feel for it. Part of what drove that was I had, as you would naturally think, if you're going to write a book set in the Civil War, you would turn your attention toward the South, the Virginia border, Pennsylvania, and all the battles down there. But what occurred to me one day was, this is 15 miles from the Canadian border, and nobody ever asked what was Canada doing, you know, the Canadian-U.S. border looking like during the Civil War era. And so once I started asking those questions, this whole other world opened up, and some of the kind of zaniest ideas around the Civil War that have been ignored. I mean, this is a serious book, but they seem so bizarre.
Like what?
In retrospect. Well, the one that plays a big part in the book is the story of Johnson Island and the Philo Parsons. John Yates Beale, a real character, is hired by Jacob Thompson to commandeer the Philo Parsons, which is his steamer, take it to Johnson's Island, which was a Civil War prison camp, had several thousand Confederate soldiers held prisoner there, to then hijack a warship, the only warship in the Great Lakes, put the soldiers on it, and take it to Buffalo and burn down the city.
You know, it happened in 1812, the only American city that was actually destroyed in a foreign war.
Exactly. So there's a history there. But spoiler alert, that Buffalo does not get burned in the Civil War.
Once was enough.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But the it opened up this whole question about what the Canadian sympathies for the Confederacy at the time, because Canada was just a territory of England, Great Britain at the time, and much of their economy was based on Southern cotton.
Yeah, right.
So although they were opposed to slavery and aligned to the Union, that was in jeopardy a lot of times.
Well, there wasn't much in the North American economy that didn't owe a lot to slavery. The finance industry, the textile industry, there's really nothing that would not have been built into what it is today were it not for the backs of those enslaved people. Would you read another section for us?
Sure. So this is Joe's arrival in Town Line. He's caught a train. He's been put on a train on the way north, and is told to get off at Town Line because the Copperheads are active further close to the town, the city of Buffalo. Joe jumped from the train and cracked his knees on the frozen ground. The train came to rest at a long building on the edge of the field near a clutch of horses tied to a post outside. He could see men standing at a bar through the yellow windows of the station. He moved as fast as he could, but the open space left no place to hide, and the full moon lit the field like a calcified sun. He winced as each footstep left a snow-white scar in the gray of the train's coal-ash trail. He had measured nearly 2 miles when he heard horses and the bark of a dog. He dropped to his stomach, and he turned his head to see the silhouette of two riders making their way up the road, passing a bottle between them. They were mismatched, a skinny boy bundled under a threadbare coat on a mare so swayback his feet were on the verge of touching the ground. The other, a giant of a man with an unkempt beard and a shearling coat open to the frigid night air, riding a gray-black stallion. The dog scampered from one side of the road to the other, nose to the ruts in the frozen mud.
That's Darren Wong. He is reading from his new book, The Hidden Light of Northern Fires, and he's going to be reading in the Triangle and all across the state, in fact, and we have links to his dates at our website, stateofthings.org. Darren, it's a wonderful book and a great story, but I don't want to let you go without talking about the fact that you've had a career in public radio, interviewing authors and promoting literature and created the Decatur Book Festival, which I think is still the largest book festival in the U.S. or something like that?
Well, it's the largest independent, which means there are several that are much bigger. There's Miami, Los Angeles, the National, but those are kind of run by large organizations, whereas Decatur, which draws between 75 and 85,000 people, was run by a couple of crackpots and a rented office.
Well, the point is, you've been around literature for a long, long time. This is your first novel. What was that like for you?
It was, it was lucky because I really hadn't pictured myself as a writer growing up. It always seemed like too intimidating a task. What turned out is I had kind of built up this group of friends that were that knew what they were doing and were really willing to help me out. So whenever I'd run into a problem or I'd have a draft done that wasn't quite right, I had a writing community.
That's right. And people have owed you one. And that's always good. You are on a 61-stop book tour, and it includes Townline. You haven't been there yet. What do you expect will happen then?
They might run me out of town on a rail. I don't know.
Well, it doesn't even take a rail. They could run you out of town, like on a half a rail. It's not that
exactly
big a town.
Yeah. No, I'm really looking forward to being back in Buffalo, and I'll be at the Alden Historical Society, which I think is going to be a really lively conversation. I've been posting some stuff online, and the place has changed a lot, and it hasn't changed a lot. I went to this house maybe 5 years ago and knocked on the door and asked if I could look around, and they told me no. I'm hoping they'll let me in this time.
Now that you got this under your belt. Darren Wong, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Frank. This has been a real pleasure.
He's the author of The Hidden Light of Northern Fire. He's going to be reading from the book in Chapel Hill, Raleigh, Durham, and Greensboro next month, and you can get the details at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.